Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm Paul David, your host, and I'm joined today by two doctors, Dr. Alex Snow and Dr. Rebecca Allen, the co-founders of Preactive. We're here today to talk about digital prehabilitation. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Paul David. Great to see you.
Good to see you. Just so our listeners know, we kind of go way back to the days of the Bethel Green Ventures Tech for Good accelerator. It's part of the reason I'm here in the country, because I was able to get a visa off the back of that. But we had a little fledgling startup, and these fine folks actually took their startup forward and are doing amazing things with it. So first things first, before I give you a big long intro, what is digital prehabilitation? Just give our listeners like a little snippet if you can there.
Sure. So if you think about prehabilitation, it's a bit like rehabilitation, but before major surgery or major treatment. And essentially, it's preparing you for that major insult that's going to happen to your body. And it's fantastic. It's been shown to reduce the risk of complications, reduce the length of hospital stay. And it also has a financial benefit for trusts by those reduction in bed days. So not only is it a better outcome for the patients, but it's also great for hospitals as well. Digital prehabilitation. So classically, it was delivered, either you get like a paper handout that you take home, or you would do it face to face with a physiotherapist or a health coach. And sometimes you get tele prehabilitation as well, where you'll get a phone call from a physio or health coach as well to talk you through a program. And what we've really done is tried to harness technology to be able to deliver really individualized prehabilitation programs using logic, and they're dynamic, so they adapt to the patient's progress so that you get the best out of your program. And it also widens access to prehabilitation. It means that rather than the few patients that get those face-to-face appointments, everyone has access to effective prehabilitation.
And I think one point that I'd just like to pick up on here is that's really important is that prehabilitation has to be individualized, otherwise it's not effective. So everyone's different. Clearly, everyone's at, when you're having surgery or cancer treatment or, you know, other major treatments, people are starting at different points. People are having different treatments. People have different medical backgrounds, mobility backgrounds, all of these things. So there's a lot of variation in that cohort of people. And all of the evidence is based on individualizing that prehabilitation, not just giving them a generic or a one-size-fits-all approach. That just doesn't work.
Thanks for sharing that with our listeners. And that it's like a new term, I think, for a lot of our listeners to kind of understand the prehabilitation and also the digital piece as well. So really appreciate you explaining it. Just taking a step back for our listeners, I'm going to tell them why they should listen to you, because y'all are wonderful NHS clinicians, just lifesavers in your spare time, no big deal. But in your journey, it sounds like time and time again, you saw patients that were, needlessly suffering from complications during major surgery. These are folks' loved ones, their aunties, their uncles, their cousins, things like that. Folks getting turned away on the day for not being fit enough for their scheduled procedure, for as an example. I mean, in both cases, patients remain in the hospital longer, creating, these infamous longer waiting lists that we, see in NHS care. So y'all came up with kind of an untapped solution, and one that received very little attention. So this is this individualized prehabilitation that you're talking about, essentially, making a patient as healthy and fit before surgery via exercise and lifestyle changes. This is kind of the unsexy bit, but it's very important. And y'all focused on that.
Yeah.
You mentioned how it's individualized and how it's been shown to cut complications in half and reduce a patient's stay by an average of 2 days. So, at a time we're talking about saving money in the NHS, this is a massive, massive opportunity to save both, human time, but also cost for the nation. So it's improving health outcomes and surgical outcomes. So the two of you saw in rare cases that individualized prehabilitation was available. It was prohibitively expensive. So when the world went down in lockdown in 2020, which I remember, I was kind of there with you in the same cohort. You all decided to do something about it, and it was inspiring to kind of see the early days of your journey. So Q Preactive, a digital platform that creates individualized prehabilitation programs for its users, delivered entirely remotely. Tell us really quickly, how'd you get to the name Preactive? How'd you land on that?
We went around a few different ones in the end, and it was a combination of the prehabilitation sort of being and the preventative medicine part that we were focusing on and trying to get patients as active as possible. Now, prehabilitation isn't, you touched on already, isn't just exercise, although that has the main body of evidence behind it, but it is also lifestyle changes. So smoking and alcohol cessation, looking at your nutrition, looking at your mental well-being as well. But we wanted to coin that getting active, getting people engaged with prehabilitation to get those benefits.
I quite like the way it's also sounds a little bit like proactive and being proactive about something. I mean, not only did we want to do that, but every day, you know, when you're around other clinicians, they're all constantly talking about the patient's frailty or performance status. And they're just clinical terms for how active, how able a patient is. And it is the elephant in the room for what the patient's outcome is going to be. And everyone who's in the NHS just thinks it's crazy that we are not doing more about it. Because why we're not investing in a preventative strategy such that when patients, you know, hit the ground and they come in for their surgery or their, you know, their treatment, their cancer treatment, for example, why they are not optimized before that is slightly, you know, it's maddening really sometimes, because you then see all these complications. These patients go to ITU that wouldn't necessarily need to, that you know, potentially don't survive. When you talk about some of the more major surgeries, you know, cardiac surgery, it's 1% of people who have elective cardiac surgery, you know, will die. And that's a planned procedure. It's something that I don't think is appreciated by people when they walk through that door for their assessment for surgery.
Well, what do you make of that? Like, it's a funny, like, societal and sectoral blind spot, right? Like, we prepare students for tests, you know, even to be a, you know, a cabbie, you got to get the knowledge, as they call it, you know, in London, and you got to train as a barber, you got to work up to things. But in this case, we kind of just, all right, show up however, you know, you are as a patient. We're not prepping you, not preparing you, not saving you time, saving the system. Like, what do you think accounts for that blind spot in the system?
I think that, yeah, it's a really good point. And it's so true, isn't it, that in this sector, it is a blind spot. But I think the reason is because it's like, you know, that the proverbial kind of frog in a pan of boiling water. As gradually patients have got older and more comorbid, it's become more and more of a priority. But, you know, maybe in the 50s and you know, in the past, patients either weren't living as long or weren't living with so many comorbidities, and we weren't doing so many operations, and patients just weren't eligible for these treatments. And then again, you know, for example, like Bex's specialty is hematology, you know, blood cancers, there has been a massive change in the eligibility of patients for that treatment. You're seeing it in oncology as well. And so now the patients that are coming in need optimizing to a much greater extent than they did before. So I think it's crept up on us, and now we are suddenly seeing that actually we've let it creep up on us so much that it's actually a real priority now.
That's really interesting. So kind of like, you know, almost the victims of our own complexity of the systems and the treatment needs and plans and things like that. That's really interesting.
Yeah, exactly that.
Yeah. Just to sort of round out the introduction, I'm still introducing you guys. You know, you've been working on kind of ensuring success in our patient success in specific pathways, and to kind of, you know, ensure ease of use for NHS staff, you've both worked extensively, you know, alongside NHS departments, as well as hiring healthcare professionals yourselves. As a result, and kudos to this, the platform is now being scaled in both private and NHS healthcare providers. So that's very, very exciting. You've even got a bunch of pre-seed investment, and I'll have you talk about that in a second. But yeah, I mean, just congratulations, you're there. Want to ask specifically, you know, say, you know, knock on wood, say I had a major surgery planned in 3 months' time. What would the NHS offer me in terms of pre-ability? Where might I go to receive it? And how does it impact patient outcomes?
Sure. So unfortunately, still most trusts don't provide prehabilitation. However, that is changing. So there were some guidelines that were brought out last year saying that, recommending that all hospitals provide prehabilitation at least to high-risk patients. And so there is a real movement to start providing this service. if you go to the majority of hospitals where that is provided, you'll get either a paper handout with generic exercises, you know, the little stick men that you often get. But as Alec touched on before, it's not individualized, it's generic. It might mean that certain patients can't do some of the exercises. It's also quite poor on adherence, and often they end up in the bin. Some trusts provide information over the internet, but again, it's usually generic, so it's really reliant on the patient looking at those exercises and adapting them themselves if they aren't exercises that they can do, and taking on board that lifestyle sort of education and really being very proactive about making those changes. If you're very lucky, you'll get this face-to-face or tele-prehabilitation where you will have a health professional on the end of the phone or as I said, face-to-face. But because it's difficult to scale that and you need numerous health professionals to be able to deliver it, you find that only sort of 5-10% of patients get it. So they're usually the high-risk patients who have multiple comorbidities, who do tend to be the ones that will get the biggest benefit out of prehabilitation. But that's not to say that everyone else doesn't also get a benefit from prehabilitation and they don't have access to that. And that's really where we kind of stepped in with Preactive to really try and widen that access to prehabilitation, that everyone gets effective, individualized prehabilitation to really get those benefits. So the reductions in complications, increasing the speed of recovery, not needing to stay in as many days, improving same day discharges, for example. Patients are carers for you know, relatives, their loved ones, so they desperately want to get home and be back on their feet, and that also impacts, you know, has bigger societal impacts if they're not able to do that. If you are being referred to, usually the referrals are from the preoperative assessment clinic. So that tends to be just before your operation. So an anaesthetist or a preoperative nurse will assess you to see if you're fit for your anaesthetic and see if they need to optimize your health in any way before your surgery. Often those appointments can be as little as 2 weeks, even a few days before your surgery. So you don't have very much time to prehabilitate if you're referred at that point. And that's the classic place patients are picked up. And what we've been working on and now deliver is that we can pick patients up from when they initially go to see their surgeon and they're booked for surgery. So for example, with a total hip replacement, the average waiting time is 4 months. So you've got 4 months to prehabilitate and you're going to, you know, really see those benefits within that time and making full use of that wait time.
And walk me through, like, how exactly would I access that care, that prehabilitation care via Preactive?
Yeah, of course. So if the surgeon, the nurse that you're seeing, the physiotherapist or the anaesthetist, depending on who's seeing you and at which point through, whether it's at preoperative assessment clinic or whether you from your surgical clinic, they will send you out, you'll get sent out a link essentially. So they'll click to say, yes, you're going to be prehabilitated. The patient gets a text message or an email as well with an individualized link within it that they click on, register, and that's it.
That's amazing. Really, 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 really streamlined. I want to dig into kind of, you know, the impact on surgical outcomes. Are there specific types of surgeries or patient groups? You kind of mentioned one, you mentioned the hip replacement, that could benefit the most from prehabilitation?
So it's a very good question. There's quite a bit of complexity behind it. But I think first of all, I'd probably start off by talking about who benefits most. And so traditionally, anesthesiologists or anesthetists in the UK will group patients based on their ASA criteria, which is a simplistic method of pigeonholing patients. So you get ASA 1, they're fit and healthy. ASA 2, they have a mild systemic condition. ASA 3, they have a severe systemic condition. And then ASA 4 and beyond are very seriously unwell. So the ASA 3s, so they've got a severe systemic condition and will benefit the most from prehabilitation or to a very large extent from prehabilitation, makes up 45% of patients. So it's not an insignificant number, even those patients who've got severe systemic condition. And then a large proportion of the ASA 2 patients also will significantly benefit from prehabilitation, from a from improving their muscle strength and cardiovascular fitness. And there's also an argument that other patients will benefit to probably a lesser extent, but to some extent, because by improving their muscle strength and that sort of thing, they will rehabilitate more quickly and be in a better position to get a better outcome from their surgery. So that's the kind of groups that we're talking about actually influencing. And then the improvement that prehabilitation offers is related to reduced risk of complications. So less chance of getting a pneumonia, less chance of having a heart attack around the time of your surgery, that sort of thing. And then massively important for trusts and for the government at the moment is reducing the number of days that the patient spends in a hospital bed. So if you prehabilitated already, you are going to be, when after you've had that big stress response to surgery, you are going to be getting up and about, you're going to be working with your physiotherapist more effectively straight away, you're going to be more likely to get out of hospital more quickly. And that not only is great for you, but is great for the healthcare provider as well, because that means they can put someone else in your bed more quickly. And so they can get more income, they can influence that new patient's health outcomes in a more timely fashion, wait lists go down, all that sort of thing. So that reduction in bed days has a manifold kind of effect on other areas. And the criteria that we're sort of using for complications, for example, and part of the reason that individualized and the specific type of prehabilitation we use is high intensity interval training, or specifically around that type of intervention, because it's quick and it pushes your anaerobic threshold or ventilatory threshold. They're both very similar sort of measurements. And it pushes that up quickly. And that is directly linked to complications and death around surgery.
I just had a vision of people in like hospital gowns, like throwing huge heavy balls at the wall and kind of like jumping. Yeah. Like that. That's what came to my mind. But
yeah,
like,
yeah. In a CrossFit immediately.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. What I was going to say is picking up. Because we're doctors, we're very much in favor of evidence-based medicine. And that's why we often get asked why we didn't roll out quicker. And we really wanted to make sure that we did a clinical trial to prove. So it wasn't just us saying that Preactive was great. It was externally validated. And within that, we had, so one of your questions you were saying about which surgeries is it appropriate for? So it's agnostic. So it can be for any types of major surgery and it will have an improvement. And with the patient type, Alec is totally right. The higher risk, more comorbid patients will have the biggest benefit. But we saw throughout the trial, patients who you would class as fit actually had huge fitness increases and benefits from taking part in even just a 6-week course of prehabilitation. So there really is benefits to be had for everyone. And what we really found is even those patients who were very fit and were potentially doing a type of exercise every week, it would be one type of exercise. So it'd be like they go for walks, for example, or they do Pilates. And actually there was quite a lot of room through doing high intensity interval training and focusing on not only cardio, but also resistance training, that you could improve not just their anaerobic threshold, but also their functional status. And that gives you the reserve to get through the major insult on your body from treatment and also recover quicker. And if you do have a complication, that you bounce back a lot quicker.
Yeah, you sort of perfectly predicted my question, which is around for a practice that is so underdone or not done at all in a lot of cases, like, did you all have a provability problem? Like, how did you, so you did a trial, like, how did you show up and say to investors and to private healthcare providers and to the NHS, like, hey, this is a thing that you should do and we can prove it to you? Like, walk us through that a little bit.
Yeah. So that, as I said, because of that kind of medic background, we were like, we need to prove this, rather than, although we had a real passion and a real belief in the theory and that there is a wide body of evidence showing that prehabilitation is effective, we were doing it in a new way and delivering it in a different way. So we did a feasibility study so that we could prove that the adherence and that retention, as well as some secondary outcomes looking at sort of fitness level improvements, was at least as good as face-to-face tele-prehabilitation methods. And actually, it turned out to be slightly better than a lot of the studies, which was great. Our adherence was fantastic. So that's why we kind of went for a clinical trial, and also to get that external validation. That's so important, not only from investor point of view, but also from healthcare providers. So we partnered with the Royal United Hospital in Bath and collaborated with the University of Bath to undergo the trial. And we went through full ethics. It was definitely, I think, the longest part of setting up and using a business model to push our innovation forward. But it was also is one of the most valuable things we've done.
Yeah, I remember from the fellowship, like y'all had lots of hoops to jump through, and just kind of like watching from the outside, I was like, man, they've really got, their work cut out for them. And, it was much easier for the rest of us who just had to build a prototype and shop it around a little bit. So, kudos for that.
It's a really interesting space, actually, in terms of digital health, because there was an explosion in digital health a few years ago. And then everybody realized suddenly that the vast majority of it is not actually evidence-based or particularly validated. And so there's been a recognition in the last few years that there is a need to make sure that these products or digital products in particular are actually fit for purpose. Especially when, we're talking about healthcare, direct patient delivery rather than potentially, an operational thing. That's particularly important.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of our early clients was actually wearing them the Oura ring. And, we did their content strategy, and we had to be really, really careful and work closely with their science team to make sure that the content that we were putting out on their pulse blog was research backed, and have sign off from the science team, and then communicate that to the social media team and make sure that the creatives that were going out were factually accurate and things like that. So the bar for digital health is incredibly high, as it should be. It's a shame that stuff has gotten through that wasn't as validated.
Yeah,
and they're definitely tightening up on the medical regulations around it. For digital offering, you need to have DTAC compliance, and that's really good, because when it was first coming out, we know other founders who have now exited their health tech companies, it wasn't around when they first started with the, sort of the first flock of sort of digital health tech, especially kind of really spurred on from COVID. But it's definitely more regulated now, which is a positive and should reassure patients.
We'd love to hear a bit more about your entrepreneurial journey, because I've seen a little bit of a window into it, but you started in, I guess, 2020, and until now. Would love to hear how you built the app, from the ground up, and what took the most of your time and your focus, how your focus has maybe shifted from year to year as digital health tech entrepreneurs.
Yeah, so we were both practicing doctors. So I work full time on Preactive now, but at the time we were both practicing hot doctors. And it sort of really started from our personal and work experiences. So we kept sitting across from patients who were undergoing either major surgery or major treatments for cancer, and they were so underprepared. And often some of the first questions would be, is there something I can do? And we had nothing to offer them. And more evidence was coming out about prehabilitation, but there was just such poor access to it. We thought this was something that was really important to tackle. We've both been very interested in the benefits of fitness on sort of your health overall. So it was kind of an easy step for us to make and something we were passionate about. And then we kind of started the classic entrepreneurial journey where we started around our kitchen table and our time off from our busy hospital schedules. And Alec was actually fantastic. We sort of had the idea. We'd started writing out the algorithms and logic that would be associated with it. And Alec went around various universities. It was a very scrappy, lean manner, and found an IT team that did it as a project. So our first MVP was built by the university team as a project. And that got us onto Bethnal Green Ventures. And then from that, Bethnal Green Ventures Accelerator, which I know, Paul, you've already gave a shout out about, but it was fantastic that we had the medical background, but we didn't have the business acumen and had no idea how to start a startup. Neither of us had done it before. Or you'd done a small one with a colleague before. And that kind of really propelled us forward. And then it's always the funding, isn't it, to be able to grow. And we were fortunate enough to win a Women in Innovation Award from Innovate UK, which that grant helped us then get the clinical trial, which then invited the investors and the hospitals to get on board. And then that allowed us to do our raise. And it's fantastic. We've now got sort of 10 people within our team. We have a whole multidisciplinary team that, you know, design and build the product from a clinical side. And we have an in-house tech team who are really senior and fantastic. So all of the product is proprietary and owned by Preactive. And we were very lucky. We never had to outsource.
That's amazing. Yeah, as someone who, like, I had to outsource a lot of my, you know, product development, things like that. I mean, that's such a journey to go on. You must be literal and figurative proud mamas and papas. You know, you've got little ones, but you've got this fourth little one and Preactive. And yeah, someone who started a company too, sometimes I look at it, just like, look out over the team and, you know, a little single tier. I'm like, wow, you know, it's really, it's wild to think about. So yeah, business owner and founder to founder, like, I definitely understand that journey and relate. Well, digging into that a bit more, I would love to understand, you know, your growth strategy. We're you know, a growth strategy agency. We work with a lot of, you know, tech for good startups, help them with their marketing and branding and web presence. What's your plan? You know, how you got this team now, you've got a great product. How do you look to grow it? Obviously, you're in a unique space and growth means something very particular to you. So talk to us about your growth strategy.
I think, I mean, underlying it, I think, is being credible and maintaining that really stringent focus on evidence and evidence base, and continuing with that, you know, that research arm on one side of the business whilst also developing a more commercial side to support the rest of it. So I think it's really important to have those two streams. I think that also is reassuring to potential customers and partners, because it shows that we are using our background and the insights we have into the health service and healthcare delivery to make sure that it's actually appropriate for the market and for patients. That would be my...
Yeah, I think with the sort of growth, we really started with knowing that we needed to have that evidence-based medicine and the clinical trial. That was probably what took us the longest to get going. And then based on that, that's enabled us to commercialize. We've got the evidence that backed it. And sort of the earlier adoptions were from our network. So because we were clinicians in the space, it was then obviously easier that, and we've, as doctors, we've moved in our training, we've moved around many hospitals. So we were able to leverage our networks to help our growth. And then beyond that, sort of growing further is through, really within the health tech space, is recommendations are one of the best ways of growing. You know, once it's been successful in 1, 2, 3 hospitals, it's much easier to then spread to further trusts. And now we're sort of, yeah, as you rightly say, not only investing in that growth of the number of hospitals that we can serve, growing our team to be able to support and give a fantastic customer service with that, both for the patient, but also for the trust itself, and continuing to support that research arm. So we've got some ongoing research projects, and we also built within our system anyway is doing real world health economics to continually prove our ROIs.
And say a little bit more about the real world health economics. So, like, just define that for our audience so they kind of understand how that works in practice.
Yes, of course. So we collect data looking at the number of bed days saved. Bed days is always a little bit of a political hot potato, because it's not always just patients that are kept in because of health. It might be because a care package, for example, isn't ready. So we also look at patient readiness for discharge. So when a patient felt ready that they could go home, we look at complication rates. We look at adherence, retention. We also look at satisfaction and whether there's been not only an impact on fitness levels, but sort of activities of daily living, things like function assessments, sort of mobility, for example, mood as well, to really get a full picture. And we feed those metrics back to the hospital in quarterly reports. We also have a really cool customer dashboard for clinicians. So not only can they review each of their patients, but they can also see the global metrics for their hospital and their cohort, which is live. so they can constantly monitor how patients are getting on.
What's nice is that actually the health economics, so the health economics when everything was delivered face to face were a bit more challenging because it is very expensive to do that on a 3 times a week basis, for example. But because, you know, the whole premise is that we're changing the delivery method and we're reducing that cost profile by, you know, a factor of 10. And so therefore, actually, the health economics, and because there are so many benefits and healthcare delivery itself and complications and an extra bed day are so expensive, actually, the health economic argument is quite easy to is convincing.
Yeah, and I feel like this is the exciting stuff with like digital health, like, you know, the metric, you're feeding metrics back to the hospital, you know, and you've got, you know, dashboards for clinicians that they can, you know, and all the things you're measuring, like that's the exciting stuff. Like, sometimes I think about my Oura Ring, all the data it has on my health and me, and like, it's just, this is the frontier, you know, like what we can do with that data to improve people's wellness and health span is really exciting.
Yeah, completely. I mean, at the moment, what you do when you assess someone's fitness is you just ask them, you know, most of the time people just get asked, can you get up a flight of stairs? How far can you walk? You know, how validated is that really when it's reported by the patient? And then there's so much sort of bias around that, that there's many, many times in my clinical career, I've been caught out by patients misreporting that and actually their risk profile being significantly worse than I thought based on the history taking.
Yeah, and that's so like good of you to have such integrity about it. That's so scary to, you know, to receive a patient who's, you know, in a higher risk factor than you expect them to be, and, you know, changes you're thinking about them, your treatment plan and how you respond. I mean, that's gotta be.
That's so true. And that's a really good point that I think people don't often appreciate is how much clinicians take that information and make huge life changing decisions about your eligibility for treatment, or how you will be managed, or the specific treatment you get, especially more true probably than hematology, where, you know, the patients, the treatments they can be offered vary wildly in terms of the burden, in terms of how difficult they are to manage those treatments because they're so toxic, but also it's the best way to say it, but I suppose the...
I think what you're going to say is that a lot of, you know, from my background with hematology, some of those treatments are curative and some are palliative. And at the moment, there aren't many quantitative ways that you can measure someone's fitness, how much they're going to tolerate that. So it's very much from sort of that history taking. You make fundamental decisions on whether that patient is going to have palliative or curative treatment. And that's huge. So if there is a possibility that we can change not only your outcomes and that you can have reduced complications, but the type of treatment you're going to receive, and, you know, and that can then is those long-term health benefits, isn't it? It might mean that you can live for many years to come and you're totally cured of your cancer is huge. So that's where, and we might talk about this in a little bit, but we're not just focusing on major surgery anymore. We're also focusing on oncology prehabilitation. And that's where the other huge area on evidence base for prehabilitation exists. So Macmillan put some guidelines out all the way back in 2017 saying all cancer patients should receive prehabilitation. And that's not just with complications, it's also around your ability to endure some of these chemotherapies. So if you are able to tolerate and recover from these toxicities and the side effects better, you then don't have dose reductions in your chemotherapies, for example. You don't then have your chemotherapy stop partway through because you're unable to tolerate it. And therefore, obviously, if you're able to complete the course at higher doses, at the recommended doses, then you are going to have the better long-term health benefits from that.
Amazing.
You said it better than I could. Wanted. You're the hematologist.
Any final bits you wanted to get in, you know, about Preactive, about the product, about anything, because before we pivot to kind of the rapid fire questions?
Yeah.
I think the only thing was maybe to plug what else coming out at the moment. So not only do we do prehabilitation for major surgery, we've had some new developments recently. So this is the tailoring to surgery date. So you don't just get a fixed course of, you know, 8 weeks of prehabilitation is quite common. It will be 4 months, 6 months, whatever time you've got, it will adapt to that. So that's one of our really big hurdles that we've overcome recently. We've also added in rehabilitation. So we were getting more and more requests from hospitals as we were going around and talking to them about rehabilitation, that they wanted patients to actually continue with the same platform into rehabilitation. And then actually, usually the rehab in hospitals is very good, but once you get home, there's very little in the way that patients get given, and especially individualized rehabilitation. So we've extended into rehab as well. I've touched on, we've moved over to oncology, and that means that not only do you get individualized programs, you also get advice, and we're looking at adapting programs based on their symptoms. So partway through your cycle, you might not feel great on certain days. It's about sort of adapting that, and maybe you need a rest day that day, or maybe you just need some gentle exercises. And all of that is mapped out and planned for you within the app. And lastly, we've also been developing, along with an ILS partner, a digital falls prevention program. So that's very much falls programs. There's, again, very little out there. There's some face-to-face. Generally, it's face-to-face in community centres, but you can imagine that's quite difficult to get to for a lot of patients. So it forms barriers to access. You don't do it as frequently as a result. And again, it's so important to be individualised. I think Public Health England did an assessment on the sort of health economics of face-to-face falls prevention programs. And there was no, from a cost point of view, no benefit. So we wanted to address that problem by producing something that was affordable, but still had really effective care. So it's really focusing on mobility as well as muscle strengthening. So that's also available.
The cost of patients falling is enormous, and they make up a huge percentage of the number of attendances in A&E, and it takes them a really, really long time to get home. So if you're even preventing one fall, that is a huge value to the trust.
Yeah, I really relate to that. I've got an elderly parent who's in a care home right now. And I was thinking, you know, as part of this, you know, prep, I was like, where have I heard of or seen prehabilitation? And it's in the care home. You know, my dad's got this incredible team, and I'm actually meeting with them. It's our quarterly, you know, care update. And he's got a social worker and a nutritionist and a physical therapist. Wow. And whenever he has an appointment, they send me, you know, the update, and they prepare him for that appointment to make sure that he doesn't fall on the way to the cardiologist, or that he's, yeah, you know, doing a little bit of extra physical therapy before he goes to see the urologist or what have you. And it's, I think, an interesting example, at least in the veterans care system in the US, which is very socialized, unlike the rest of the system, of prehabilitation for elderly, you know, elderly folks like my dad. So.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear he gets that, because that just needs scaling out, doesn't it, to everyone, you know, in those similar positions.
Yeah, everyone deserves a care team. You know, they calls their loved ones, and, you know, sometimes they'll call me, and they'll be like, his earwax, he had a lot of earwax. I'm like, thank you for this call at 8 a.m. on Tuesday. I needed to know that. But it's lovely. It's like really nice. It's like, you know, they're calling someone who cares about him and letting them know that he's had something, you know, so.
Nice. Oh, that's great.
Yeah. Cool. Let's jump into the lightning round questions. So these are quick, snappy, and I don't think we've ever had a couple actually do these. So
maybe like a buzzer.
Yeah. Maybe you'll learn some things about each other here. I don't know. We'll see. But these are meant to be like quick, snappy questions to kind of help the audience get to know you a little bit better on a more personal level. First question, if you could found another tech startup after Preactive, what would it be and why?
Yeah, so I did actually come up with one at a similar time. And Bex, you thought it was quite amusing.
That's right.
So it was, first of all, I mean, you know, the ideas are the 1%, aren't they? But at the same time, using drones to deliver key healthcare equipment or resource. So number of times you're in a surgical environment and they haven't got the right size knee replacement or whatever it is, and can't do the operation. So all of that team are there ready to do that operation. You're ready to go, but they haven't got the knee, you know, the actual metal part of the knee that goes on the femur or anywhere else.
And that exists now. That's it.
Well, it's sort of in its infancy still, but there's definitely some areas in London that are like looking at it very closely. You can also use it for blood delivery. So let's say, yeah, that's happening, especially with platelets, which have a very limited shelf life and that sort of thing. And And that's, I'm pretty confident that's happening in London. So yeah, that was my idea, but yeah, that's, you weren't so keen. But that's fair enough. I think probably that wasn't our area of expertise.
Nice. How about you, Bex? Did you have one?
No, I piggybacked onto your idea, really, to be fair.
Yeah,
that's fine. Just hop on the drone.
I was like, okay, the drone one. And then I quickly ruled that out in favor. Well, actually, to be fair, Preactive was our primary one anyway, and that was our second idea. But I was a bit mean, wasn't I? I was like, what if it crashes? You'd need to have loads of people to control the drones. And yeah, it's actually...
You were just preparing him for the inevitable investor, you know, inquisition. Right, yeah. So yeah, you're welcome, basically, for that inquisition.
She's the hardest into it, that's for sure.
Relatedly, what tech invention makes you the most excited right now?
It's a generic answer.
It sounds really generic.
It is going to completely revolutionize healthcare. And I think physicians are a little bit, you know, everyone's a bit anxious about it within health tech. But, it, you know, there's so many fantastic advantages it brings.
It is going to. I mean, when you actually dig into the detail of it, so AI is such a broad way of referring to it. But you could, let's say, AI for protein mapping. So, for example, you know, most of the ways, you know, relates to drug discovery. So you want to know that one drug will bind with a specific receptor, and that receptor is made up of a protein that is in a very, very specific shape, and it has to link to a very specific area. And at the moment, it is done by, you know, some mapping and modeling, and then trial and error in terms of producing experiments and seeing how well it works. That takes ages, absolutely ages, to actually experimentally do that. Whereas if you do that with AI, it is going to happen in minutes, hours, and they're going to be crazy that the drug development that's going to come out of that. And then, you know, clinically, and then things like radiology, you know, already there's a huge, because it's all related to the data, isn't it? And right. how much it can learn. So if you're saying, well, you've got all of these images of patients having mammograms, and you can feed all of those into an AI, and it can learn, you know, it can learn off of that data very, very quickly, and very, very quickly become better than humans. And radiology is perfectly placed for that because it has access to that data, because radiology is all on, has been on computers for 20 years.
Yeah.
And interestingly, like some of the, when you're looking at whether clinicians outperform AI, there's been some really interesting studies about that. You're nodding your head, so you've probably seen them.
Yeah, I think I saw that, like, they've already, like, the AI has already surpassed the clinicians in terms of identifying, you know, cancerous cells and mammograms and things like that. I think I've seen something along those lines.
Exactly. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. But also, really interestingly, I thought was that they're, it also outperformed the clinician and the AI. So just AI.
Oh, interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Interesting. So obviously there are biases that the AI isn't susceptible to. So yeah, it's going to be a really interesting time to be in medicine from that perspective.
Wow. Interesting. So yeah, flip side of that question, what tech makes you the most concerned right now?
Still AI. although literally what you've just said is that those studies showed that AI did better on its own, is still that fear, isn't it, of unsupervised AI starting to learn on its own whether it is doing clinically sound decisions. And there's still fear around that. And I think that's going to exist for quite a while until there is enough, it's happened enough that we can analyze that it is safe.
Yeah, doesn't bode well for the future war against the machines if the human versus plus AI loses to just AI in these trials. So we'll see. Yeah. Yikes. On a lighter note, we always like to ask this. This is a human question. Who is a literal human who has been integral to your career journeys that you'd like to shout out?
Yeah, so I'd like to shout Melanie Hayes from Bethnal Green Ventures. I think so, specifically our journey within health tech, she has been really pivotal as a guide and how to take a startup and accelerate it forwards. Yeah, her knowledge and expertise has been invaluable.
Yeah, I completely agree. I can't speak well enough at Melanie. She's, yeah, she's very, very talented and gives exceptional advice in the VC space.
Nice. Shout out, Melanie. And then lastly, we always like to end on kind of an inspirational quote that stuck with you on your entrepreneurial journey in tech. Does anything jump out?
Yeah, I quite like how these coming out with these things. But I like don't throw good money after bad, actually. I think that's a particularly hard one to act on, because sometimes you will have gone down a certain, you know, certain line of thinking or experimentation, but you have to admit to yourself if something isn't working and pivot, and not get too hung up on the fact that you've invested a reasonable amount of resource down that, in that direction, because actually by investing more resource down that direction is actually, there's nothing you can do about the money that's already been gone, but you can do plenty about the future spending that you might push down that route if you don't believe it's going to be successful.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's one of the ones, like, you could just cut that in half, be like, just don't throw money, like, invest it, place it, you know, squirrel it away maybe, but don't throw it. Like, just, you know, that's never
it's
good.
It's two quotes.
Yeah. Don't throw money. Rebecca, did you have one you want to jump in on?
Yeah, I have always lived by this one for a long time, but I always think you're often put down by, you know, people, oh, it's too competitive or it's too difficult. And I've always said, but someone's got to win. So why can't it be you? And I think, you know, trying is so difficult, isn't it, sometimes with imposter syndrome and all sort of the negative thoughts in your head, but you've got to be super positive about yourself and be like, actually, you know, if you don't try, you won't know. And not to be afraid of failure. It's okay to fail. That's the when you grow the most. And just really throw yourself into things, and someone has to win that grant, someone's got to win that award, and you definitely won't win it if you don't put an application in and try. So a great believer of trying, and it's okay to fail.
I remember that moment. There was like a day before they announced the Bethel Green, you know, Ventures like winners, and I was talking to my coach at the time. I was like, oh, I'm not going to get it. They don't give funding to people like me. And they were just like, why are you talking like this? And it was, you know, I very specifically remember, I think I was in Hagerston Park taking a walk, talking on the phone, and then something shifted, and then I got it, and
yeah,
we both did as well. So
it's been one of the times I've really thought, it's like, people kept telling me, oh, well, only 2% of female founders get investment. Oh, great. As I'm going out doing the pitches. And, you know, you've got to like try and park that, haven't you? Like that sort of negative thoughts and run with the positive.
Absolutely. Well, that's a great note to end on. But want to thank you both, Drs. Alex Snow and Dr. Rebecca Allam, co-founders of Preactive. We talked today about digital prehabilitation. They're doing amazing work with private health providers and in the NHS. And we're so grateful to have you on the pod today. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, great to see you, Paul David.
Of course. And where can folks find out more about the great work you're doing with Preactive?
Yeah, so you can check us out on our website, so www.preactive.co.uk, or on LinkedIn.
So we'll drop some links in the episode description to that. And just to our listeners, thank you so much. Please give us a rating, a subscribe, a follow, so we can keep bringing great guests like Rebecca and Alec onto the pod. Thanks, everybody.